pussy sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning
with the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading from Hayti Police, Memoirs of a Former Durham Police Officer, by Marshall Thompson, written in 1997. Resuming in Chapter 5, a description of the aftermath of the race demonstrations in April 1969. As a result of the demonstration, blacks were hired in most of the department stores downtown in upfront positions. The streets were paved all over Durham, except for a very few. The whites began to accelerate their pace in leaving downtown to place their business in shopping malls and shopping centers. The black community lost the business section and a large area of the residences of Hayti to the Durham Expressway. It was as if the powers to be were saying, "You can have some, but not all." The loss of Hayti created a vacuum from which blacks over 40 years old have not recovered. The early employment opportunities for young blacks seemed to disappear with their community. Drugs and guns added to the destruction. Crime began to increase on a grand scale. It has continued to this day among the youth in particular. They don't have the traditions to hold on to, or the opportunity to work, as I did for Jerome Harris Shoeshine Stand, where you learned that all hard work was dignified work. While working at one place like Mr. Rome, you could deliver groceries and baked goods and clean other businesses when things were slack at Mr. Rome's. You also learned how to operate a business when working for other business people. Successful businessmen like George Bell of Bell's and Sons Amoco and J.W. Jackson of Grill 55 got their start in Hayti working for Jerome Harris Shoeshine Stand. Too many young men now would think shining shoes to be demeaning. There's nothing demeaning about honest labor. Sure, one can probably make more money at first in an illegal enterprise. But how many retired old drug dealers do we know? Most wind up sick, in jail, or dead before their times. It's a real American tragedy that's played out every day. Drugs and guns contributed to their demise. Chapter 6. It would take a much bigger story than I'm telling now to include what I know and experienced as a young teenager in Jerome Harris Shoeshine Shop on Pettigrew, in the middle of the Hayti business district. Because of the strict rules of behavior that Mr. Rome, as we called him, imposed on himself and his employees, I will be forever grateful. For instance, being late to work was tantamount to being absent. He never told a person working for him not to curse or fight, but he surely would charge you for doing so. To Mr. Rome, the customer was next to God, and he treated even the worst customer with the greatest respect. "Thank you, sir." "Thank you, sir," or "madam," he would say to each and every one as they completed their transaction with the shop. All customers were important whenever they entered his store. He also treated his shine boys as men, even when they didn't deserve to be treated as such. Mr. Rome had only one hand, the other having been blown off by a grenade that a soldier had left in a seat in his shop. He never let this hinder him in any way. His shoeshine rag was made so that he could place his wrist in an opening on one side of the cloth. He had at times 4 to 12 young men working for him. Mr. Rome even had white men, and at one time white women working in his shop. Everyone got along. Mr. Rome ran a tight ship. The average weekly salary, or commission, was $3 to $4. It sounds laughable, but if you worked for Mr. Rome, you were rarely ever broke. Sometimes the police officers would stop in and get a shoeshine. They paid their 15 cents like everyone else. It was 20 cents if your shoes were off your feet. High-top shoes were 20 to 35 cents, and boots were 50 cents. You had to work hard for the money. Payday was on Sunday nights at 7 p.m. We all sat on the seats beside each other as Mr. Rome called us down one at a time to be paid. After he had taken out expenses for nabs and drinks and comic books, the average pay was $1.50 to $2 per person. I know of no instance where Mr. Rome was ever accused of cheating his boys. After we all got paid, we'd go first to Marvin's Hot Dog Stand, where you could get 2 hot dogs for 15 cents. Then we went to the Regal Theater. The movie was generally over by 9 to 9:30, which got us all home by 10 p.m. I always had lunch money for the remainder of the week. I know of only one instance where Rome boys ran afoul with the law. None of us at the time were ever arrested by the police while we worked for Mr. Rome. The police respected us because they observed us working every day, and they had very high regard for Mr. Rome. Rome boys became career military men, accountants, businessmen, artists, ministers, law enforcement officers, and some entertainers. Mr. Rome died during the early 1990s. His age was one of the best-kept secrets in Durham. Some say that he was a veteran of World War I. Men like Mr. Rome are not made anymore. I can only recount a little of his story here. Chapter 7. In the summer of 1951, Officer Otis Parker and Officer Frank McCrae were partners in uniform patrol when they received a domestic fight call on Willard Street in The Bottom. The Bottom does not exist at this time, but for years it was located 2 blocks south of the American Tobacco Company, which was then one of the wealthiest business enterprises in America. Ironically enough, The Bottom was all black and very poor. All the streets in The Bottom were dirty and dusty. When it rained, they became muddy quagmires. Some of Durham's most notable citizens came from The Bottom. These names come to mind quite readily. Ernie Barnes, the famous artist. Billy Hayes, successful college football coach. Dr. Bass, one of the best dentists in the state of North Carolina. And Prof. Alston, the best dean of students Hillside High School ever had. McCrae and Parker were headed south on Willard Street when, upon approaching the scene of the domestic disturbance, they were facing the barrel of a shotgun that was being pointed directly at the front windshield of their patrol vehicle. Before these officers could take evasive action, the man who was involved with the family fight squeezed the trigger on the shotgun. Otis Parker was struck in the head. Frank McCrae was struck in the chest. The citizens in the area called the police. The police from all over town converged on the scene. The shooter surrendered immediately to the police who came to the scene to assist. The 2 wounded officers were taken to the nearby emergency room at Lincoln Hospital. Otis Parker was a staff sergeant at Camp Butner during World War II when the riot occurred in Durham in 1943. He had a significant role to play in convincing soldiers to stop rioting and go back to the base. He bravely got in front of and among them to make them stop. The police officers never forgot Sergeant Parker's bravery. Officer Parker had a job in the police department waiting on him when he was discharged from the military. In 1945, he married a local young lady named Luvenia, and a daughter was born to them in December 1945. Otis Parker survived the shot to his head, but he was never the same anymore. He was in and out of the hospital until he died in 1972. His daughter, Anita, graduated with me from Hillside in 1963. Frank McCrae recovered from his chest wound in pretty good condition. In April of 1951, McCrae and Clyde Cox made detective. J.B. Samuels became a second lieutenant at the same time. Chief King wanted Lieutenant Samuels to be head of a black precinct in Hayti. There were no other precincts in Durham at that time. Samuels refused. The black officers continued to check in at police headquarters, just like everyone else. Soon after Cox and McCrae made detective, they had to go to New York to extradite a prisoner back to Durham. They had to go before a superior court judge to get the prisoner released. The judge looked at them in disbelief after he had heard their request. He then said to them, "There are no colored people in the police departments in the South, not to mention detectives." Cox and McCrae replied, "There are, sir." The judge made a few telephone calls. The judge, who was white, then said, "I apologize to you fellows for my ignorance. Before you take the prisoner back to North Carolina, I would appreciate it if you would have dinner at my house." Cox and McCrae did have dinner at the judge's house. Generally speaking, it can be said that because blacks were on the police department, many changes for the better came about between the average citizen on the street and the way they were approached or treated by the police. For instance, most black officers gave people a title to their name, such as Sir, Ma'am, Mr., Mrs., Doctor, Professor, and so on. Even if you gave a drunk in the street respect by giving him a title, the respect earned by that officer was immeasurable. Even a dog needs a pat on the back sometimes. Respect generally worked from east to west and from north to south. Then, when a black officer had to chase someone on foot, as all officers do, the black officer was less likely to respond by striking the fleeing suspect once he was caught. Not to say that black officers never use brutality. Some black officers could be your worst nightmare. Generally, though, they were more respectful of a person's civil rights. The laws of arrest, search, and seizure changed dramatically during the years that blacks came on the force. All officers had to have classes constantly to bring them up to date on the changes. Another thing that changed over the years that the general public was not aware of was the language used over the police radio regarding black suspects. Male suspects were called "nigras" frequently. I was riding with Officer T. Richardson one night when one of the dispatchers used that term. This was in 1968. Officer Richardson stopped the patrol car, went to a police call box, which are no longer used, in front of Hillside High School on Concord Street, and had a few words with the dispatcher for using that word, "nigra." Richardson retired in good standing, but, like myself, he was considered a quiet militant. Promotions came slowly, or never, to so-called militants. How hard you worked didn't matter if you were tagged as a militant. I was proud to be one. The battle had to be fought in one form or the other, every day. Chapter 8. A week before I was to be sworn in as a police officer in the city of Durham, I was a part-time driver at the Yellow Cab Company. I was headed east on Simmons Street soon after some rain showers had made the street slick. Simmons Street was paved. I had my mind on looking for the trip that I was supposed to pick up. I saw the lady waiting near some steps on the other side of the street. My attempt at a U-turn was not successful. A police car struck my cab on the left front as I was making a U-turn. Being involved in a car wreck is a shattering, traumatic experience. Thankfully, neither I nor the officer who was driving the police cruiser was injured. The officer was headed east on Simmons Street also, but he didn't know that it was now a dead-end street because of the construction of the Durham Expressway. The black officer called another officer to investigate the accident. I waited in silence, thinking about how this accident would affect my going on the police department. The lady had to call another cab, of course. The next week, on August 1, 1968, I was sworn in on the police department by Police Chief Pleasant's secretary while I was sitting in a chair beside her desk. I had envisioned a great swearing-in ceremony, but nothing like that occurred. The automobile accident that I was involved in with Officer T. Richardson had no impact whatsoever on my coming on the force. The first officer that I rode with as my training officer was T. Richardson. We began to argue immediately about who was at fault in the wreck. Officer Tim Leathers, the officer who'd investigated the accident, put me at fault on the wreck report. He did not put me in traffic court, however. I found out during my stay on the force, and after 2,000 wreck investigations of my own, that not all the time the person at fault must be cited to traffic court. The insurance company just needed to know who the officer considers to be at fault. It took several wrecks that I had to investigate before I discovered that I was at fault. I had to apologize to Officer Richardson several times for this and other incidents where he was proven right and I wrong. The other black officers who were on A Squad at the time I came on the force in 1968 were Lieutenant J.B. Samuels, J.E. Hunter, T.R. Gilmer, and N. Lawrence. Lieutenant Samuels had at that time 24 years of experience, J.B. Hunter 15 years, T.R. Gilmer 13 years, T. Richardson 1.5 years, and N. Lawrence 8 months. I had the good fortune to learn from all of them. Hunter and Gilmer at one time had been partners for 12 years. If one of them started a sentence, the other one could finish it. N. Lawrence, who some called Wild Bill, was a Vietnam veteran, like myself. He was the only black officer on the squad who was not married at the time. Napoleon Lawrence was very aggressive on patrol when dealing with individuals with aberrant behavior. T. Richardson had spent much of his Army experience stationed in Alaska. He was very patient and soft-spoken. T. R. Gilmer, like J. E. Hunter, was over 6 feet and over 230 pounds. Both had played football in high school and in college. Lieutenant J. B. Samuels was the first black lieutenant in the South in 1951. He was instrumental in starting the North State Law Enforcement Association, which included black officers from all over the state of North Carolina. We all got along with each other and the white officers. All our experiences on the street were the same, anyway. Captain Ellen, a Korean War veteran and former Marine drill instructor, was in charge of A Squad. Most squads, all four of them really, had about 20 officers on each squad. We, as uniform officers, worked swing shift at this time, 3 to 11, 7 to 3, and 11 to 7, with days off in between shift changes. A Squad was on 11 to 7 graveyard shift when I started work in August 68. After assembly was over, Captain Ellen called me up to his desk with the other three rookies. There was a cereal bowl full of water on the captain's desk. Captain Ellen began to talk. He said, "Gentlemen, each of you put your hand in this bowl of water, and then take it out." We did so, one at a time. "Gentlemen," he continued, "you see how fast that bowl of water filled back up when you took your hand out?" "Yes, sir," we replied in unison. "That's just about how fast you will be replaced or missed if you mess up out there. Pay attention and stay alive. Dismissed." "Yes, sir," we replied again. I worked on patrol car or on the street with three of the five black officers on my squad until the police academy started 2 weeks later. There were 16 men in my academy class, which lasted 6 weeks at that time. When I retired in October of 87, all had left the force except for three. Chapter 9. In July 1944, when J.B. Samuels and Clyde Cox came on the Durham Police Department, police headquarters at that time was located in the old Red Top County Jail. The sheriff at that time was Sheriff Eugene Cat Belvin. The sheriff then and now is responsible for security at the jail. The sheriff was so upset that these two men were on the police department that he would lock the toilets so they couldn't use the ones at the county jail. Times do change, though. By 1970, one-third or 26 men of the Durham Police Department were Afro-Americans. Durham, at that time, was a city of just 100,000 people, with a 45% black population. Only Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C. had a larger percentage of black officers. By contrast, Houston, Texas, a city of 1 million people, had only 20 black officers. Durham police had blacks in numbers, but not many with rank. That fact, among other inequities, ended after 1970 to 71. The black leadership on the police department at that time, Sergeant J.W. Price being in the forefront, decided that we would take our grievances to City Hall. The other black leaders were E.A. Allen, Coolidge McCoy, Red Cameron, and Lieutenant J.B. Samuels. We were protesting the fact that even though we worked very hard, we were not considered an integral part of the whole police department. Our demands included the right to work in all parts of Durham, to investigate white-on-white crime, promote more black officers and detectives, and place blacks in all areas of the department, such as communications, identification, records, traffic division, etc. On the several occasions that we presented our demands at City Hall on Morris Street, there were a great many students from North Carolina Central University, Duke University, and other schools in the area sitting in City Hall supporting us. Ironically enough, these were some of the same students who were involved in the Civil Rights Demonstration of April 1969. All of our demands were met, but the strength of our demands were diluted by the public safety concept that the city manager encouraged the city council to adopt. Public safety officers were trained to be firemen and policemen. This controversial work relationship continued on from 1971 to 1984. In 1984, the police and fire departments split up again, but this time with high-ranking blacks on each. Durham became one of the few cities in the 1990s in the country where, at the same time, the fire chief and the police chief were blacks. It can only happen in America. Thanks to the sacrifices made by the early black police officers, and black firemen too, no one will ever lock the bathrooms on us again. Durham has been a city of first for blacks for many years. The first black highway patrolman, Raymond Johnson. The first black SBI agent, Clarence Gooch. The first black U.S. Marshal in the South since Reconstruction, Joseph Biggers. Let's not allow them to be the last. Remember the proud shoulders that they rode on. The Hayti Police. That brings us to the end of Hayti Police, Memoirs of a Former Durham Police Officer. Marshall Thompson didn't stop with that book, though. In 2005, he published Hayti Shorts, a collection of daily events by a retired policeman in Durham, North Carolina. We'll read a few of those. Possession. During the early summer of 1981, I received a call concerning a lady in the 800 block of Liberty Street having problems with her sister. Sergeant Hill and I arrived at the apartment on the ground floor. We knocked, and a lady said, "It's not locked. Come on in." Upon entering, we observed middle-aged black female trying to hold on to and contain another female near her. The lady who was doing the holding said, while gasping for air, "My sister came up to visit me from South Carolina, but I don't know what to do. She's not talking to me at all." That's when we noticed her sister's condition. She was foaming at the mouth. Her bloodshot eyes stared straight ahead, and she was growling like an animal. I immediately called for EMS, and then Sergeant Hill told the lady that we would have to hold her sister in order to handcuff and contain her. The lady replied angrily, "Oh, my sister is not a criminal." We explained to her that we know she's not a criminal, but she must be restrained until the ambulance arrives. The lady said, "No!" A struggle ensued, and the lady got tired. Finally, she said, "All right, handcuff her, if you must." We did. We then sat her in a chair and waited for the EMS ambulance. The sister from South Carolina continued to growl and foam at the mouth. The lady who'd called us then said, "I want to hug my sister. I love her." I said, "Lady, I wouldn't do that if I were you." She reached for her sister anyway. The sister from South Carolina bit her in the stomach. The lady cried out in pain, "Why did you do that?" EMS came and gave the South Carolina woman a knockout drug. Her sister also had to go to the hospital for being bitten in the stomach. That was the end of the involvement for the police. We never got called to that apartment again. I'm guilty. In the late fall of 1968, I was riding in a police car with Officer J.E. Hunter, a veteran at the time, of about 13 years on the force. I'd been on the force for about 2 months. The only places that black police officers could work during this time was the section of Durham called Hayti and points south to the city limits of Durham, which was Riddle Road. We had just received a call about a shoplifter at Sears Roebuck and Company, which was located at the intersection of Dillard and East Main Street in downtown Durham. The juvenile female being held by the store police was 14 years old. She did not appear frightened at all by the event or by our arrival at the scene. Because she was a juvenile and well-behaved, we decided to take her home until a juvenile counselor could take the case. It was obvious to Officer Hunter and me that this young black lady was what we considered middle class. We called her home first to inform her parents that we would bring her home and what she'd been charged with. I could hear her mother talking to Officer Hunter on the phone. She was giving him a fit. Any parent can be upset about their children having a run-in with the law. Middle class, black or white, are seemingly the worst. The way the mother was talking to us, one would think that we were the ones who'd committed the crime. We didn't have cages in our police cars then. I sat in the back with the young lady while Officer Hunter drove us to the front of her residence. She lived in a beautiful house on top of a hill. The mother ran out the front door and down the hill, berating both Officer Hunter and me all the way. She ended by saying, "My daughter did not do anything." The young lady replied out loud, "Mama, yes, I did." Get me an ambulance. I was walking the beat on Pettigrew Street one hot fall day, soon after completing recruit school, in October 1968. The area called Hayti was still in full bloom as a business district for blacks, but soon after 1969, its demolition was to begin. I was proudly walking on Pettigrew, near the spot I used to shine shoes for Jerome Harris shoeshine stands. I had spoken to Mr. Rome, as he was called, when a man I didn't know approached me very quietly and asked politely, "Officer, will you get me an ambulance?" I asked him, "What for?" He replied that his wife had told him that she had broken her leg. Scarborough Funeral Home was on the next block, but I felt that I needed more information. We did not have walkie-talkies then, so I used someone's business phone to call for assistance. Pretty soon, Officer Wesley Crudup came by in his police cruiser. Wes, as we called him, was a brilliant man who at another time could have been an executive at IBM. He once asked me, and proceeded to explain why people have automobile accidents. Wes stated that people try to disobey the law of physics that no two objects can occupy the same space at the same time. Wes had the male subject and me get in the police car. He then asked the man where he lived. The man directed us to his house behind the businesses on Pettigrew Street. All three of us went up the steps to the front door. The screen door was locked. We knocked. A man ran out the back door. Our man's wife screamed, "You fool! Why did you come back so soon? I sent you for an ambulance." We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.
I think we can hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.